Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com. My guest today is Mike Underwood, writer of The Shootout Solution, which is out soon from tour.com publishing. Mike is also the writer of Geekomancy, Celebromancy, Attack the Geek, Shield and Crocus, and The Younger Gods. He's a co-host for the Skiffy and Fanti show and also manages sales and marketing for Angry Robot Books, and I presume never ever sleeps. Mike, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Well, thankfully, when I got the cybernetic implants to join Angry Robot, sleep is one of the things that they took out.
Yeah. So you just plugged in directly to do this podcast, right?
Yeah, I just, got the nice 80s-style cyberpunk jacks. It's pretty rad. You know, Mark, the Angry Robot founder, is a classic punk, so we don't do 21st century ports, you know, no wireless.
So you can't, like, wiggle an ear and get Skype. You have to jack into something.
You know, it's more visceral that way, I think.
This is true. with the shoving in things in your head, yes, I can imagine. But let's tell everyone about The Shootout Solution and the genre knots. What's your elevator pitch for the Shootout Solution?
Yeah, so the shortest version is it's like Leverage, but for stories. That being Leverage, the TV show, which is all about a group of thieves who kind of band together and become good guys in order to protect the little guy. And with genre knots, what we have is a group of storytellers who travel between dimensions. Every other dimension is the home of a story genre. And what they do there is find, kind of workshop, and then fix broken stories by, you know, donning identities and manipulating the narrative. Because if they don't fix the broken stories, then there's a ripple effect between that dimension and their home world, which has lots of nasty repercussions that build over time.
So how did the novella come about? Was there a premise or a single image or an idea that you started with? And had it been with you for a while before you wrote it?
Yeah, a while back I had just a very tiny story seed of a notion about a woman who kind of has a portal fantasy situation, falls through something that puts her into a very stereotypical kind of high fantasy world, and that she'd be brought before the king or queen of this kingdom, and they'd be talking about how there was a great darkness upon the kingdom and that there was a traitor, and she'd just point to the right hand side of the king or queen and be like, it was him, it's the vizier, because he has the Van Dyke at the goatee, it means he's the bad guy. To take a character who is genre-aware and throw them into a story world and see what happens.
Now, the idea of storytellers having adventures, trying to fix stories, trying to fix holes in worlds where entire genres live, that's really cool. I really enjoyed that. What genre of world do you think you'd best survive, and which would you best be able to fix or save?
Probably the ones that I'm most equipped for would be, like, Elizabethan drama or some kind of action-adventure story, just because I've got some historical fencing experience, and I spent 5 years in the Society for Creative Anachronism, so I'm used to, like, wearing mid and late Elizabethan garb, and the action adventure kinds of stories that fit in there with the swashbuckling are all very much in my kind of aesthetic wheelhouse.
Swashbuckling, huh? That's not what I was expecting. It really, really is far off from what I was expecting. Do you think there would be much swashbuckling in Elizabethan drama? I suppose it depends on the drama.
Yeah, you know, if we're thinking of something that's, you know, a little bit Three Musketeers, but then also a little bit Shakespeare in Love or something like that, where you get swordplay and banter and adventure and jumping off of carriages and things like that.
And what genre of world do you think you live in now?
Right now, I'm very happily recently married, so my former life in romantic comedy, kind of bemoaning ridiculous and various sundry misadventures in romance, all that is taken care of. So now I'm just in whatever genre one describes for, like, the perpetually overcommitted geek of the 21st century, which basically means that I'm, like, adjacent to the TV show community, but my life is not quite as bizarre.
Well, that would be fun, wouldn't it?
I think I could take a little bit of bizarre here and there, and part of what makes that show so charming is that the stakes are incredibly high, but on a very local and personalized level. I get the sense that in the universe of Community, other people have, like, fairly normal and tolerable lives, and that just at Greendale, it's like it's a hellmouth but for weird instead of, like, actual monsters.
Yeah. That's a really good way of describing what Greendale is like, a hellmouth for weird. So you have all these really cool, interesting academic degrees. What made you do what you did in college and for all these, you know, for multiple degrees, for which means obviously many years? Were you always headed towards storytelling, or, you know, were you ever going to end up, I don't know, an engineer or a politician?
There probably are several alternate dimensions where I'm an academic. Coming into college, I had studied Japanese language and culture to a degree all through high school, and I was on a trajectory, I thought, that would take me through an East Asian language degree, and then I'd like work for a manga company bringing manga over, or I'd move to Japan and work for a video game company and kind of do cross-cultural something. But I was a freshman when 9/11 happened, and like many of my colleagues, I was really, you know, or classmates, I was really shaken. And through one or another source, I had heard somehow that Joseph Campbell, the mythologist,
right,
had some relationship with George Lucas. And being a big Star Wars fan, I was like, I'm going to investigate this, because I'd always been sort of interested in folklore and mythology as a kid. So I picked up The Power of Myth and Hero with a Thousand Faces, and they really kind of cracked open my brain and got me very excited about mythology and narrative as a way of framing, understanding, and changing the world. And so that got me onto the individualized major program at Indiana University, where you can basically build your own major. And I proposed and got accepted a major in creative mythology, which ended up being take some classics, some anthropology, some folklore, some creative writing, and smash it all together. And my thesis for that degree was a kind of a creative thesis. So it was a bunch of short stories and an excerpt of a novel where I was trying to apply the analytical frameworks and the aesthetic understanding of having studied world mythology systems and putting them into my fiction. So that was kind of the undergrad level. And then by that time I was like, oh, so this is what I'll do. I'll become a scholar. I'll go get my PhD and then teach. And then during the summers or off semester, I'll write my fiction. And so I did my master's in folklore studies, mostly focusing on contemporary culture and tabletop RPGs, with a little bit of kind of general geek culture scholarship and area of interest. And that was where my PhD was going to be. I was going to do a dissertation on geek reactions to the mass commoditization and popularization of geek culture. But that was me trying to get into grad school in 2007. So I was a few years early because I was in it and I saw what was coming. But I didn't get into any PhD programs. So I moved back home and started doing some kind of wacky retail jobs and taught at community college for web design using skills I'd picked up here and there. And then got into the publishing industry.
Was the community college a hellmouth for weird?
It was not so weird, but community started, I think, maybe in the second year that I was teaching at the community college. And a lot of the hear funny things about the small insular world of community colleges, they really resonated, even though I only spent about one day a week at the community college. So whoever was working on community, I think they had some experience there, either teaching or having attended one, because they seem to have nailed it pretty well.
Were you writing at this time as well, while you were doing all, you know, the retail jobs and teaching?
Yeah, I had been writing pretty seriously for what I thought was being serious toward the end of college, doing the creative thesis. During my MA, I didn't get to write as much because almost all of my output was going to the scholarship. But I did get into Clarion West and I finished my thesis, submitted it, and then Saturday, the day after the last day of finals, I drove up to Seattle to do Clarion West. And that really kickstarted my writing. And after moving back home, I took one of the short stories I'd been working on at Clarion West, which was the very first version of Shield and Crocus, and turned it into a novel, which was the feedback I got from all of my classmates and from the late, great Graham Joyce, who was our instructor that week. So with that kind of encouragement from Graham and from my classmates, I started writing Shield and Crocus. And from there, I was getting more and more serious about my writing and started publishing short stories until I sold Geekomancy in 2012.
An aside, how wonderful to have been taught by Graham Joyce. I was a huge fan. He was also a wonderful person.
Yeah, Graham was amazing. He was our week three teacher. And for the first 2 weeks, we were just very studious. We were heads down. We didn't go out very much. And so he came in and really kind of got us up out of our rooms and out of the writing areas. And every night that he was with us, we went out to a bar or to a pizza place. And what he did for us really was to encourage us to gel and to become friends to a greater and more rounded degree than we had been. He also taught me a huge amount about revision, because his process was to basically do the biggest problems first. And then each stage of revision was divided instead of trying to revise everything all in one pass, which is what I've been trying to do before and was really frustrating.
That sounds like good advice.
It was. I've taken it and modified it for myself, but it's basically that processual version that he kind of provided to us in that week three that I still use.
Which leads me nicely to talk about your writing process. What's it like now? Is it very different from when you first started out?
Yeah, I've become progressively much more of an outliner. When I started, it was very much that here's a couple of ideas that I have, and I'm going to kind of find my way through, and I would develop it so that I'd have maybe an end state in mind, and I'd be writing toward it. And in fall 2013, I took Writing on the Fast Track, an online writing class with the fabulous Mary Robinette Cole. And what Mary did, and the process that she described, is to do more thorough outlining. And starting with, it's almost like the snowflake method, but maybe not quite. Start with the core of an idea and then build it out and build it out and build it out. And we were focused mostly on short fiction, but she also gave us some notes for writing novels. And then I've taken that, and with each project, especially the longer fiction, but short fiction as well, since then, I've given myself more of a path. And the mental switch that allowed was for me to think of every draft or every version of the story as a performance, and that when I'm revising, I'm not, getting rid of work. I'm not having something that's wasted. I'm finding a better way to perform or to get across the story that I'm trying to tell.
Now, how do you balance, and jokes aside, when maybe not jokes aside, I did say earlier, maybe you never sleep, because there is a question from Maineke on Twitter. And she says, when does he sleep between his job, his writing, his two podcasts, the man is a machine? Now, we figured out that you are a machine, but let's leave that aside for a second. How do you balance the day job with the books and the podcast? And obviously, there's reading that's always, there to be done as well.
Yeah, so I'm very lucky in that working in the science fiction field and writing in the science fiction field, a lot of what I do double counts. Anytime I go to a convention and I meet people, I might end up working with them for Angry Robot, or I might end up in a table of contents with them in a short story, or try to collaborate with them. So Mark, the founder and publisher for Angry Robot, is very supportive of the fact that I am a writer and have that career, because it gives me a lot of connections and understanding of the business. So when I'm doing day job work and I'm on Twitter signal boosting other Angry Robot authors, or I'm researching stuff in Publishers Weekly or in Locus, all of that applies and gives me the knowledge that I can then use in my writing and developing my own personal marketing skills and going to conventions, making connections there, rolls back in and makes me a better sales and marketing manager for Angry Robot. A lot of the bookstore connections that I've made myself or in my previous job as a sales rep are now the people that I talk to when I'm trying to get Angry Robot authors in. So those two jobs meld together really well. It does mean that when there's drama in science fiction land, it's really hard for me to escape it. But Mark is very supportive of my writing. And because everybody else in the Angry Robot team is in the UK, except the assistant that I share with the other division in Watkins Media, if I need to make my schedule flexible a little bit, he's very much supportive of that. And it's been a great combination so far. In terms of podcasting, on Skiffy and Fanti, I mostly just show up for episodes and talk about the media bits, which are TV shows and movies that I was excited to see already. And what the podcasting does is it gives me a social outlet, because I work from home and my wife works and commutes. So she's gone during the day, but she's a homebody, and I work at home and I'm a social butterfly. So podcasting is one of the ways that I can connect with people. I've just started now working on the second podcast, so there may maybe be a little bit of time organization process that I have to figure out there. But I like to stay busy. If I'm too bored, then I end up just playing video games for hours and hours and hours. And I'd rather play a little bit of video games and then talk to people.
Playing video games for hours and hours, isn't that just the worst?
Well, there are, I think there's healthier and less healthy ways of playing video games.
I was being facetious. I actually don't know how to play video games at all. So I know people do it for a very long time and find it deeply satisfying. I have yet to understand why.
Yeah, I started playing video games when I was pretty young. My dad got a Commodore Amiga when I was maybe 4 or 5 because he'd probably gotten it surplus from the university he worked at. So video games have been a part of my life for a long time, but my relationship to them has really changed. Having so many other things to do now, it's one of the ways that I wind down. I also watch twitch.tv streamers, people who play video games and then broadcast them, because that's another way for it to be social.
Tell me about a little bit about who your heroes are when it comes to writing, who they were when you were a child. Are they still the same now that you're an adult and now that you're, you know, a published writer yourself?
I think they've definitely changed. One of the first fantasy narratives that I encountered was the BBC Books on Tape version of The Lord of the Rings. I remember that. It's the box with the really cool kind of goldish style dragon. Though that may be the Hobbit box, I could be misremembering. And, you know, just 13 cassette tapes. And I'd listen to it as my bedtime stories, basically. So the narrative there, I'd never read until I was a teenager, but The Lord of the Rings was really firmly ingrained in my head. So like many people, I came to fantasy through Tolkien, but very quickly after that, I also read A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin, and it's had as much, if possibly not more, of an influence on me because of the gorgeousness of the language, making me really impressed at what the genre could do, but also thinking about culture and that it was a setting that was really unlike The Lord of the Rings. So those were big ones for me as a kid. Star Wars has, of course, been a gigantic influence. So Lucas and Lee Brackett and the other writers of the original trilogy, Star Trek, so Gene Roddenberry, and then the big Star Trek for me was Next Generation, and then Deep Space Nine and Voyager to a lesser extent. I've also been influenced a lot by comics, so that'd probably be mostly Chris Claremont, and then more recently Warren Ellis has been a big favorite of mine. In science fiction prose, Octavia Butler, and specifically the Xenogenesis saga and then Parable of the Sower, really kicked my butt in an amazing and inspirational way. Octavia's writing is it's bold, it's kind of heart aching, but there's always the sense that things can be better, even if it's not particularly likely. And being an optimistic person, I appreciate kind of a contrasting view where there's a lot of grimness and some frank cynicism about humanity, but not presented as inevitable, that this is how things are, but we can make a change. Much more recently, I was really impressed by and continue to be impressed by Nora Jemisin's 100,000 Kingdoms and then the Dreamblood duology, just because she brings such cool different assumptions and interpretations of fantasy. You know, you've got a lot of other non-Western civilizations, which I'm super excited about in the genre. And then I'm also really influenced by the writers I work with at Angry Robot. So Ramez Nam and his great combination of kind of action-adventure thriller, but also really nuanced science fiction and some influences from Buddhism. And then Cameron Hurley, whose Mirror Empire just totally kicked my ass and got me so excited that when we had acquisitions meeting for it, I was ready to knife fight somebody. I was like, all right, I will knife fight a man to get this book on the list. And then everyone was like, Mike, you could put the knife away. We all love it. So I'm really blessed with a great plurality of influences, and I try to take them widely so that I don't get kind of bogged down or narrowed into only ever thinking about the world and my writing in one way.
All right, I want to talk a little bit more about the genre not stories. We know there are more. There's at least one more, right?
Yeah, I've written first drafts for all of season one, so that's 6 episodes.
Oh, really? So you're way ahead of schedule.
Yeah, because they are shorter and I'm thinking about it in seasons, I wanted to be in a position where I could release all of season one, ideally within a year of the first episode. So the two are contracted, and then I've got pretty solid versions of episodes 3 and 4 and somewhat rougher versions of 5 and 6. And then I've got some notes on season 2 that I'll get to once all of season 1 is polished.
Tell me, which of the characters in these stories is most like you?
Of the five leads, The one that's most like me is probably Leah, who's kind of our first main POV character in Shootout Solution, though Mallory is the very first genre-naut that we meet. With the Rhi Reyes books, Geekomancy and Beyond, Rhi is a lot like me in the ways that she's a big geek, and I think Leah is a lot like me in the ways that she thinks about stories and is analyzing how stories work and how things fit in, and also the kind of dialogue or conversational aspect of stories. And with each of the leads in Genrenauts, I wanted to give them a different perspective on storytelling. So each of them in some ways represents different facets or different arguments within a broader conversation about how storytelling works. And anytime I write a character for a long enough time, I find some things of myself in them, or really I put some things from myself in them, and then I fill them out with other characteristics so that I have some kind of emotional entrance point to each character. It's really hard for me to write someone who I have absolutely nothing in common with, though I'm trying to be more adventurous and broader in the types of casts that I write in my works.
So when's the next book out?
The Absconded Ambassador is episode 2, and that was going to be out February 23rd is what we've got currently scheduled.
All right, now one more question from Twitter, because of course there's at least one more. Justin Landon, you know, who pulls no punches, asks, so much of Mike's work is self-referential genre reflection. Does he see this as limiting his work's potential?
I think that's a really fair and tough question that is actually something I struggle with, or at least keep in mind pretty consistently throughout my work. You know, I started with the Rhi Reyes books, which are very much self-referential. They're for geeks, by geeks, about geeks. And I've had some good success with that series, and it's gotten me some great readers who I'm excited to continue writing for a long time. When, in 2014, I did a couple of other works, Shield and Crocus and The Younger Gods, Shield and Crocus is kind of genre blendy and has some commentary, but it's more along a certain axis. It's more straightforward action-adventure with superheroes in a fantasy setting, and it's less about geeks and it's less about genre than my first and current series are. And then Younger Gods was the difference in Younger Gods was the character voice, because it was a very particular pronounced first person, but otherwise it really fit into urban fantasy or kind of supernatural thriller kind of territory. And neither Shield or Crocus nor Younger Gods has been embraced by as wide an audience as the Rhi Reyes series has been, and as I'm hoping, Genrenauts will be. So when I was designing Genrenauts, I took a look at what I'd already written. I looked at who was kind of talking back to me, who my readers are, and what it seemed to me was that the core of my readership, the people who are most engaged, were the ones who were interested in kind of talking about and featuring geek culture and that self-referential aspect. I do think that it puts me in a different position in terms of figuring out what other things I want to do, if I want to write books that aren't as much like the Rhi Reyes books as the Genrenauts books are in being that level of self-referential. But I think at this point, the thing that readers are expecting from a Michael R. Underwood story is that sense of genre awareness, and that it's its own story, but it's also to a degree about a subculture, or it's about how stories are put together. And that will probably be my core for a good amount of time to come. I may at some point come up with just a pseudonym, and then have that other pseudonym be the non-referential kinds of works. Probably go like an open pseudonym, like Mira Grant for Shauna McGuire, so that those are distinct and expectations are consistent.
Right.
But then I'd have a chance to do some other things if I'm interested.
So it sounds like you have a lot of things planned out.
I do. At this very moment, I have a book on submission, a set of proposals out with a different editor, waiting to hear back on more Genrenauts. And I'm developing comics pitches.
Comics pitches, that's interesting.
Yeah, so having been a comics reader since I was probably 5 or 6 or so, and then living in Baltimore, where one of the bigger, not giganto comic cons, Baltimore Comic Con, is where they hand out one of the major industry awards. I went last year and had a fantastic time, and you know, a little bug in my brain's like, well, Mike, you should just start writing comics. And I'd written a comic script for a college class years and years ago, but it was terrible. Like, ooh, no good. So I scrapped that draft and restarted with the concept. And I've been developing and redeveloping. And the latest change is trying to make it way more wacky, so that it fit more with my overall aesthetic and would let me bring some of my my writing strengths and make that work more distinct within the field. because it's a kind of an optimistic post-apocalyptic narrative about people coming together and overcoming tribalism. And one of the leads is a hyper-intelligent silverback gorilla who has a mecha suit. So I'm trying to lean into that wackiness, and then I'll keep developing and see what I can do with it.
So what's immediately next for you? What are you doing in the next couple of weeks?
The next couple of weeks and today directly are all promotion. So podcasting, I was just at the World Fantasy Convention and recorded
that?
For it was very fun. The thing that's always been the most important thing for me at World Fantasy has been the people. And this year was no exception. I got to meet up and do a lot of plotting with Mark for Angry Robot, but also meeting people and reconnecting with folks that I've met at WorldCon this year and at years previous, because there are folks that I only seem to ever see at World Fantasy, because not everybody travels right. as much. I'm in a position where I really have the privilege of being able to travel both for work and on my own, because I don't have kids at this point, and I have a solid day job. So World Fantasy on that side was really fun. There were definitely some problems. There were a lack of accessibility for the programming for people, and all of the discussions around the really terrible original anti-harassment policy, which has, I believe, inspired an ongoing conversation and joined the conversation about accessibility and inclusion in the genre that I hope will keep on applying across a variety of conventions, and the way that we as a community, when we're a community, are going to talk about and make these things happen.
And of course, they've decided this is the last year that that the Fantasy Award will look like Lovecraft. Is that right?
Yes, they announced that at the World Fantasy Awards to very, very positive response in the room. And from Twitter and what I could tell, a lot of positive response there. And there's been pushback from people, and they're welcome to their opinion. But I think this is really the right choice for moving the genre forward into the 21st century and having it be more accessible and inclusive to people who in previous years and even right now, a lot of the genre is just not friendly to. And we're stronger when there's more voices from more perspectives.
Absolutely. I am in full agreement with you. Now, one last question about the Shootout Solution. Give me two songs that make it work. Give me two songs that are sort of its soundtrack, or three, its soundtrack in your head.
Okay, well, let me pull up the actual story soundtrack, because I write to music.
Oh, you do? That's interesting. Let's talk about that a little bit. What sort of music did you write to for this?
So, one of my favorite writing soundtracks is the soundtrack to a video game called Bastion, which is a weird fantasy western sort of apocalypse story. Like, the entire world falls apart, and the main character wakes up, and as you scroll around the screen, the remnants of the world kind of rise up and create the space that you can walk onto. It's a very interesting approach. And then there's a narrator for the entire game who's kind of old-timey Western voice. He's like, and then the kid drew out his gun. So that there's a story about a story aspect to that itself, which kind of puts me in Genonauts' mood. And then I also use kind of music from Halo. And to give a little bit more of the wackiness, I have some material from the band called Pomplamoose. They do a few covers. So they've got like a Pharrell mashup and versions of Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go that gives me a little bit of that sense of wackiness and whimsy.
Yeah.
For Leah as a comedian, and hopefully for the series in total, where, you know, we're talking about some interesting, cool things, but we're really having a good time and some laughs along the way.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah, I've gotten to the point where if I really know a song, then even if it has lyrics, I can probably write to it as long as it fits the story. I've got probably a dozen different writing soundtracks at this point. Each of the Re-Reyes books has their own, and then I've got more general ones. And when I'm creating a new project, I'll draw from those general playlists and then fill them out with other stories that help me get into and maintain the mood that I'm trying to go for with that individual piece.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for talking with me today. It has been fantastic learning more about you and the Shootout Solution, which is, I think, now out from Dora.com.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm a big Midnight in Karachi fan, so it's great to be able to join in.